Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, who assesses recent congressional votes defeating resolutions rejecting the international Iran nuclear deal and the potential ripple effects of the agreement in Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere in the volatile Middle East. Osprey Oriel Lake of the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, who talks about how the effects of climate change disproportionately impact women around the world. And Alan Nairn, an award-winning investigative journalist, who discusses the recent resignation and jailing of Guatemalan President Otto Perez Molina on corruption charges and his complicity in mass murder and war crimes. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Spain's insurgent political party, Podemos, meaning We Can in Spanish, emerged 2 years ago out of large urban assemblies of activists frustrated with double-digit unemployment and austerity policies. The leftist party, led by 37-year-old political science professor Pablo Iglesias, surprised the political establishment by winning 5 seats in recent elections for the European Parliament. In upcoming elections in December, Podemos will be reaching out to rural Spaniards with a campaign focused on sustainable agriculture. The aim is to attract more young people to the countryside to revive a region long in decline. According to the news magazine In These Times, rural Spain's agricultural enclaves are among the least populated in Europe. Podemos seeks to expose the corrupt nature of farm subsidies controlled by established political interests. Peasant organizations, for example, revealed that 100 million euros in agricultural government subsidies were given to 80 landowners who are not engaged in agricultural production. Through its rural initiative, Podemos is looking to build on the success of the Indignados movement, whose slogan asserts that traditional politicians don't represent us. Burma's opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi opened up her campaign for this fall's historic parliamentary election in the home base of top Myanmar political insider So Thein, the architect of the Southeast Asian nation's recent economic reforms. Suu Kyi's political party, the National League of Democracy, or NLD, is confident of winning the most open election in 25 years. The Nobel Peace Prize winner, who spent many years under house arrest, is campaigning to defeat President Thein Sein's ruling military-centered Union Solidarity and Development Party. Thus far, Suu Kyi, who is barred from running for president, has been cautious about nominating members of the 1988 democracy movement for seats in the November 8th election. However, the party did nominate one of the country's best-known activists, Ma Thandar, whose husband was killed by government soldiers. The influential Nationalist Buddhists Committee for the Protection of Race and Religion, better known as Ma Ba Tha, have passed 4 bills in parliament that effectively legalize discrimination against women and the country's minority Muslims. Although Suu Kyi and her NLD opposed the laws, they rarely criticized the group for fear of alienating supporters during this election year. Governor Alejandro Garcia Padilla of the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico has laid out a new 5-year plan for debt relief that includes teacher layoffs and austerity measures. Still, the plan won't balance the books, and bondholders led by vulture hedge funds are likely to launch lawsuits to get full payment for their bonds. The plan, developed by the governor's task force, calls for restructuring $47 billion in existing debt and creation of an independent financial control board to monitor the island's finances. Puerto Rico, facing double-digit unemployment, recently sold off the assets of a workers' compensation fund. The government has also delayed paying out 2014 income tax refunds until the winter of 2016. For decades, Puerto Rico's general obligation bonds were seen by investors as nearly default-proof. But without radical restructuring of its debt, officials say the government will run out of cash by next June, forcing a shutdown of essential public services, including police and public education. On Capitol Hill, Democrats are pressing to give Puerto Rico access to U.S. bankruptcy courts to reorganize its debt, a move opposed by most Republicans. But Hillary Clinton, while on a recent visit to Puerto Rico, blasted Republicans for not stepping up to aid Puerto Rico, declaring, "You can't fix your economy through austerity." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski. We'll be right back.
Senate Republican opponents of President Obama's six-nation nuclear agreement with Iran failed to muster enough votes on September 15th to overcome supporters of the deal, who succeeded in blocking consideration of a resolution of disapproval for the second time in less than a week. On September 10th, the House of Representatives passed a measure stating that Congress's 60-day review clock to consider the nuclear deal had not started because, they charged, the administration hadn't provided lawmakers with copies of all documents related to the agreement, a charge the White House denies. As it now appears, President Obama will avoid having to veto a measure of disapproval. A coalition of peace and civil society groups supporting the Iran nuclear agreement lobbied legislators hard over the past 2 months in order to earn this victory. They overcame intense opposition by the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, that spent $40 million to defeat the nuclear deal, as well as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and neoconservative former Bush administration officials. Your reporter spoke with Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, who assesses the significance of the Iran nuclear deal's survival and the potential opportunities for future cooperation with Iran in Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere in the volatile Middle East.
This is really a victory in two ways. On the substantive part, this is an extraordinarily important development. The victory of diplomacy over war, the substance of this agreement that is so important, even though when you step back from it and say, well, wait a minute, Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapon. All 16 U.S. intelligence agencies agree it hasn't even made the decision about whether it wants a nuclear weapon or not, for God's sakes. But nonetheless, it will never be able to produce a nuclear weapon at least in the next 25 years. And in the meantime, the sanctions that have just crippled the civilian economy in Iran will begin to be lifted. So that's all huge. And then, of course, it sets the stage for even greater potential gains in terms of potential engagement between the U.S. and Iran, something that really hasn't existed in a formal way since 1979, the possibility of new kinds of diplomacy aimed at ending the war in Iraq and the war in Syria that are giving rise to these huge flows of refugees out of the region. All of that is possible. None of it is inevitable, but all of that becomes possible with this agreement.
Well, Phyllis, what lessons can we learn from this defeat of AIPAC, the Israel lobby, the personal intervention of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, neocon star Dick Cheney, military contractors, etc.? What lessons can we take away from this victory?
Well, I think one is that we have to stop being afraid of antagonizing our political opponents and our political targets. You know, the fact that people were willing to talk about AIPAC and say, AIPAC is investing money to wage war. AIPAC is choosing war over diplomacy. That was huge. Lots of people were talking about Israel's nuclear arsenal as a major destabilizing factor that unfortunately isn't included in this deal, but as a major factor that needs to be addressed. Things like that that are so often put aside on the ground, let's not talk about that. You know, we don't want to put too much pressure on our friends. You know what? Our friends can take it. So it was recognizing the degree to which there has been a massive shift in discourse in this country already and taking advantage of that discourse shift to escalate the pressure. So that's one lesson to be learned. Another lesson is that there's no substitute for having the president on your side. You know, I think we have to be careful in our assessments here that it wasn't only the grassroots side. That's what we can do and what we can control and what we can contribute. And we did, and it was brilliant, and it was fundamental to our victory. But we can't pretend that it doesn't matter that the president of the United States was fighting hard for the same thing we were fighting for, which was for this agreement to be protected, for this agreement to pass. That was huge. And, you know, again, that's not going to happen all the time. We don't agree with the president very, very often when it's issues of war and peace. Plenty of other issues, too, but those are the issues we're talking about tonight. But on those rare moments when the president is on the right side of history, we've got to use that. We've got to build that connection. We've got to back it up. So that was another lesson. We can't have illusions, but we've got to take advantage. So, there's a lot of lessons to be learned here. There were a lot of organizations involved. There were twice a week phone calls to coordinate strategy, to build messaging together. But there wasn't a lot of time wasted on creating the structures of a whole new organization or a new coalition or whatever that would have taken up a lot of time that people didn't have when we had a 60-day window to win this victory. That was another lesson. We learned that lesson in 2013 in the fight to prevent the bombing of Syria at that time, and it worked well then as well. So there's lots and lots of lessons here.
Phyllis, with a new nuclear agreement moving forward, what do you think the potential is for improved relations between the U.S. and Iran, and how could that affect cooperation in ending current bloody wars now ongoing in Syria, Iraq, and Yemen?
Well, Scott, there's no question that there's already much closer collaboration in the Middle East in these wars between the United States and Iran. It's true that inside Syria, the U.S. and Iran are on opposite sides relative to the regime in Damascus. Iran is providing military support to the Assad regime. The U.S. is trying to undermine the Assad regime, and earlier on was attacking it politically more directly. But in Iraq, for instance, the collaboration between the U.S. and Iran is very overt. So that's one of the vivid sort of examples of this shift. But we're also looking at a situation, and if you look at Yemen, there's the potential for some real collaboration to tamp down the level of violence that has been so badly exacerbated by the Saudis as they have begun this massive bombing campaign with absolutely devastating humanitarian results, and particularly in Afghanistan, where since 2001, the U.S. and Iran have really shared a commitment to opposing the Taliban, to supporting a different kind of government, the government that was put in place by the United States during the U.S. occupation in the earliest stages, was actually helped to be created by the government in Iran, who participated on an equal footing with the U.S. in the Bonn Conference in 2001 that led to the government that was created in Kabul right after the overthrow of the Taliban. So there's history of this. And in fact, if you look back to 2002, Iran offered a kind of grand bargain that would include broad negotiations over pretty much everything that was dividing the U.S. and Iran at that point, including Iran's role in the region, its relationships with Hezbollah and Hamas, issues of human rights, the U.S. denial of Iran's legitimacy as a Middle Eastern power. All of those things would be on the table. The Bush administration, of course, answered that call. The Iranians made a call for a grand bargain. Bush answered it with the accusation that Iran was part of the so-called Axis of Evil. And what a surprise, there were no more negotiations after that.
That was Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, and author of the new book, Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror, A Primer. For more perspectives on the significance of the Iran nuclear agreement, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The visit of Pope Francis to the U.S. in late September offers climate justice groups a megaphone to air their concerns and call for changes needed to put the Earth on a path to sustainability. After speaking with President Obama in a joint session of Congress in Washington, D.C., the Pope will speak at the annual opening of the United Nations General Assembly, which takes place at the UN's headquarters in New York on September 25th. Given the Pope's outspoken support for addressing global warming, the issues of the climate crisis and justice for the world's poor, who are disproportionately affected by climate change, will be high on the agenda. WECAN, the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, is sponsoring a global day of action where women around the world highlight their own demands for climate justice and promote their local solutions. What WECAN is calling a hub event for the Day of Action will take place on September 29th at the UN Church Center in New York City. The event will bring together some of the world's best-known women climate justice leaders to emphasize how women are impacted first and worst by climate change and what women are doing to take action. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Osprey Oriel Lake, executive director of WECAN, who discusses the global work her organization is doing to bring attention to the climate crisis and women's role in organizing for changes to government policies.
People often ask, why are we focusing on women? And I think what needs to be understood that women are disproportionately impacted by climate change and environmental degradation. As an example, there's a clear link between poverty and who gets impacted by climate change first and worst. And women make up the greatest percentage of the world's poor. So the stresses that many Indigenous women and women in developing countries experience as a result of climate change are more severe due to their direct reliance on nature and primary resources for their survival. Women comprise about 20 million of the 26 million people estimated to have been displaced by climate change since 2010. So there's just a whole host of reasons that are gender-related because of gender roles, how women are being the most negatively impacted. So gender discrimination really reduces women's physical and economic mobility. Their voices are not heard. And in many regions of the world, this, of course, creates much harsher conditions for women. But what's also very inspiring when we talk about women and climate change is I think one of the big untold stories is how women are standing on the front lines of global efforts to revision and heal our world and bring solutions. You know, a lot of the women that we work with, they're very clear. They say, you know, we're not victims. We're solutions bringers. We have answers. About 60 to 80% of household food production in developing countries is done by women. So when we're talking about food security and food sovereignty, we're really talking about involving women. This is also true when you look at water programs. Many United Nations studies show that if you don't have women engaged in these programs, they simply don't work because it's the women who are most often the ones collecting water in developing countries, and they hold that local water knowledge. You know, when we look more to North America, in the United States, 80% of the purchasing power belongs to women. So when we're talking about demanding clean energy and tackling issues of overconsumption and, you know, how we're exercising purchasing power, you know, we're talking about women.
Osprey Oriole Lake, WECAN, the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, has been working globally on the issues of women and climate change for many years. Where do you see things headed, toward a just resolution or down the tubes?
Well, I think that what has really improved is overall people's climate movement has grown. I mean, look what we saw in New York City last year with 400,000 people from all over the world on the streets and then parallel events and marches internationally. So I think that we've made a lot of progress in terms of awareness, the divestment movement. There's more awareness around issues concerning climate change and women. We do know that, you know, there's a lot of advocacy work being done at the UN to have gender equality be in the climate documents. But I also think the big improvement that we've seen is around climate justice itself. You know, there's a lot more awareness in the people's movements around the need for frontline communities, Indigenous communities, low-income communities to be well represented, those that are being impacted the first and worst, and making sure that they're at the front of the line, making sure that their stories are being told, making sure funding's going in their direction, and understanding not just that they're being impacted the most, but also that there's key solutions. You know, people on the front lines are having to deal with climate change most immediately, and so really innovative, important measures are coming out of those communities. And also, I think in regards to women specifically, I think that it's really essential to understand that women are modeling small-scale solutions with potentially large impacts. And I think this is essential because climate change and environmental degradation are, as we know, very large-scale problems. And so solutions are often discussed in terms of sweeping measures and top-down initiatives. However, it's, you know, precisely the centralized, monopolized, and profit-driven process of our current industrial system, energy grid, and food production networks, which have facilitated, you know, sort of the twin plundering of people on planet. All this said and done, the fact is, this is the hottest year on record. So on the one hand, I have huge hope because the people's movements are growing and building and uniting together more. There's a huge amount of momentum going into the Paris negotiations. On the other hand, temperatures are rising, sea levels rising, and we're not winning at that level. So obviously, we have much, much more to do.
That was Osprey Oriole Lake, Executive Director of WECAN, the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network. Find more information on WeCan's agenda and events by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Guatemala's president, Otto Pérez Molina, was forced to resign from office on September 3rd in the face of a major corruption scandal and demands for his removal from power by a growing protest movement. The scandal, under investigation by Attorney General Thelma Aldana, involves allegations that business people paid kickbacks to public officials in order to avoid import duties through Guatemala's customs agency. Pérez Molina's former vice president, Roxana Baldetti, has already been jailed and faces charges that she received as much as $3.7 million in bribes. The jailed former president now faces charges of conspiracy, customs fraud, and passive bribery, and will stay in detention until his trial begins to ensure he does not flee the country. The decision to prosecute Molina is considered a major victory by thousands of Guatemalans who have organized weekly protests in the capital, Guatemala City, since April, demanding Pérez Molina step down and face justice. Guatemalans will elect a new president in an October 25th runoff election. While the investigation and arrest of a sitting president is a dramatic shift from the immunity that Guatemala's elite military and political figures enjoyed for decades, there is a darker chapter of Pérez Molina's life yet to be investigated. Your reporter spoke with Alan Nairn, an award-winning investigative journalist, who, speaking from Guatemala City, discusses the former president's complicity in mass murder and war crimes in the 1980s, when he served in the nation's military.
The corruption scandal was the trigger for the explosion that brought down Pérez Molina. But what really brought him down was a massive popular movement. Starting in April, hundreds of thousands of people have come out into the streets in a massive protest, demanding his resignation, but also demanding some basic changes to the system. People have been talking about a rewriting of the electoral law, a rewriting of the Constitution. Some are hoping to break the stranglehold that the oligarchs, the old landowning and factory-owning and bank-owning families, the partners of the U.S. multinationals, have on Guatemalan society. So Pérez Molina was forced to resign. He was hauled away to prison in very dramatic scenes. The Congress of Guatemala had to approve stripping General Pérez Molina of his immunity from prosecution. And as the day began, nobody thought Congress would do it, because Congress is in the pocket of the oligarchs, of the drug dealers, of the military. Nobody thought it was possible. By the end of the day, the Congress had voted unanimously to strip his immunity, as crowds were outside of the Congress shouting for his downfall, and the members of Congress clearly feared for their own political futures. They felt that something was shaking in the society. But the bigger issue is, will he now be brought to trial for the massacres that he carried out with U.S. backing, with weapons from the U.S. And Israel? And I was in the mountains as Pérez Molina was doing this. I met him as he was doing this. In September of 1982, in the town of Nebach, in the Ishil Mayan, indigenous Mayan zone, I spoke to him as we were standing over four corpses of four men he had just finished interrogating. And his soldiers, his officers described to me how they would go into villages and wipe out all the civilians, return and bomb the villages with the U.S. helicopters. So waiting in the wings is the possibility of a trial for the massacres, since he was one of the implementers of the genocide for which General Rios Montt was convicted. And nobody knows where this will end. Nobody knows where this uprising will end, but Guatemala is on its feet, and the system has been shaken.
Alan, why has this change taken place after so many decades of a succession of dictators and rulers, many of them corrupt, ruling the country with impunity, with virtually no accountability to Guatemala's civilian population? What's changed?
Well, it's been a combination of a grassroots popular movement and a few honest professionals, attorneys, who managed to find their way into the system, honorable people who have worked with the backing of a popular movement and also with, at the insistence, with impetus from the massacre survivors. This is actually the second major historic achievement of world importance that that combination has achieved. The first was 2 years ago when General Rios Montt, the former dictator, was brought to trial in a domestic Guatemalan criminal court and convicted of genocide and sentenced to 80 years. It's the first time in history that any nation has been able, in its domestic courts, to bring its own head of state to trial for genocide. And I was called to testify in that trial. I wasn't able to take the stand because at the last minute, General Pérez Molina, who was still president at the time, stepped in and blocked me because he was afraid I was going to talk about him as well as General Rios Montt. But the trial produced a conviction. At the last minute, the oligarchy stepped in and demanded that the conviction be annulled. The case was frozen. It's now renewing again. In the end, what decades from now will be viewed as a world historic precedent. And what I've been urging is that it's not enough to bring people like General Rios Montt and General Pérez Molina to trial. You also have to bring to trial their accomplices, what in Guatemalan law are known as the intellectual authors of these crimes. And those would include the U.S. officials and also Israeli officials who sent arms, who sent advisors, who provided training, who provided money, who provided political cover, and provided the policy guidance, the doctrine that you can kill both subversives, guerrillas, and potential guerrillas, which means children. People of that kind, U.S. officials, Israeli officials, should also be brought to trial, and they should do time alongside the Guatemalan generals and officers who perpetrated this mass murder, which claimed many tens of thousands of lives. I mean, the estimates vary, but it could be more than 200,000 who were slaughtered.
That was Alan Nairn, an award-winning investigative journalist, speaking from Guatemala City. For more reporting on the arrest of former President Pérez Molina and the demand for his accountability for war crimes, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.